Essay 11. The first thing I'd say about today is gray. I woke up way before daybreak and had to wait to take my walk. I'm very impatient, so I drove off right at first light. The sky this time of year is a very distinctive gray. Day after day of it once November rolls in. It's milky, smooth but viscous, like whey maybe. What's left over after you've taken what you want? Not gray with an A, gray with an E. The very first thing I noticed heading up the hill was the scattered wreckage of toppled trees. Big brown carcasses skewed around all over the place, like industrial-scale pickup sticks scattered randomly around. They're there all summer and fall, of course, but hidden in the thick thatch of green. And by Christmas, you get so used to seeing them, they recede into the backdrop. But the first time you see these vast fields of the fallen on a leaf and green bare day like today, so gray, it's stunning. All that history laid out, decades of it in various states of decay and disrepair, amplified this year by a number of freshly downed trees, huge, taken out in their prime by teams of men Carol and I saw working last January to slow down, I'm supposing, the advance of the emerald ash borers. These trees are at least 3 feet thick at the base, 100 feet of trunk chunked up by chainsaw and rolled away from the path any which way they went. Fat slabs littered up and down and around, their rough gray bark just a few shades darker than the sky. I thought to myself, I don't think I will think anything today. It is so gray. I was mistaken. It all started about a half mile in after I took the dog leg down. There's a deep gully off to the right, up from the base of which grow a few tiny tree-like things, maybe 3 feet tall, the broken umbrella types I mentioned a few days ago. Their spindly gray trunks and branches evaporate on a day like today into the gray base of leaf meal beneath, so their remaining leaves, maybe 30 on each, bright yellow, seem to be suspended in midair, like you threw a handful of them up in the air and their lobes flash froze at all angles in a clear glass globe. Today, they made the world look topsy-turvy. Crazy chandeliers hanging up from the ground, gravity reversed, everything around them hung up from the ground. The trees, even me, upside down. My life, I thought, is just like that now, all upside down. It's been that way for so long I am used to it, oriented to it, as I will be to all of these down trees in a few weeks. I thought about the little dust-up I had with the tree a couple of days ago, the one that rebuffed me at my approach to look at it. I mentioned this event in class this week, and I remembered how, for most of my youth, well into my teens, I was like that too. Didn't like to be looked at. Beat red-faced as soon as the spotlight hit me, at school, home, anywhere. One of the most terrifying dreams I ever had was having a hand, just a big, disembodied hand, holding a broad brush paint my face crimson red. I was about 5 years old. It lasted maybe 30 seconds and has haunted me ever since. That terrifying. It is, for those who know this, a very unique kind of embarrassment. Not attached to anything in particular you may have done, said, and it has nothing at all to do with the sort of male aggression that can be invoked by being looked at the wrong way. Socially normal people might see this as aberrant, a morbid kind of shy. Morbidly shy is exactly what they used to call it. Contemporary psychology has pegged it social anxiety disorder. I can actually recall how crestfallen I felt the first time I saw this term in print a few decades ago. Morbidly shy has some drama to it, even dignity. Social anxiety disorder, well, that's just sick, one might say. Now, I thought, a frame of mind that was formerly simply an eccentricity, perhaps in certain cases even a sort of gift, a sign of saintliness or genius, now, well, just plain abnormal, neurotic, your ticket to a trip to therapy. Carol was like me in that regard, except much more so. Refused to have her picture taken, didn't even like mirrors. Ours are mostly for that reason on the inside of doors. You have to open the door to see how you look, then close it so you won't have to encounter your own image inadvertently while you're walking by. This may sound like a head-scratcher to socially normative people. It all makes perfect sense to me. That's one of the things I've been trying to think through since our discussion in class of Emily Dickinson a few weeks ago. The one that took me back to her correspondence with Thomas Higginson. I've known for many, many years, of course, decades, that in most of my identity features, I am pretty normative. Why then, I wondered, did I always feel so out of step with the general drift of things, an outlier? It struck me like a thunderbolt when I read those letters, Emily Dickinson trying to negotiate a way of advance for herself through her social opposite, this swashbucklingly manly figure. I seeing every one of her rhetorical moves, understanding perfectly each thrust and parry. While, by his own account, Higginson was always simply reduced to saying, "Huh? Who are you?" My minority status came, as I said I realized then, from my reclusivity. The aberrant class of offbeats who, like me, tend to be chided and derided. Why are you so private? Until, of course, we die. Then if we've accomplished something, something I might add that could only be accomplished from this outlier position, we are celebrated, valorized, honored. Like Emily Dickinson. That's precisely what Higginson did with her, to her. Waited until she died, then took over her poems, changed the syntax and punctuation to fit his prissy public standards of correctness, so he would not have to endure his sort of embarrassment, the kind his high-flying, socially normative position would expose him to if he had promoted an outlier like her, this original genius he discovered, without fixing her mistakes first. He could. Again, as I said, I guess I'm still pretty riled by this, thus the desire to say it all over again, have promoted her work. She walked right up to him, strong, in that first letter, 30 years earlier, gotten her career off the ground while she was still alive, still a young woman, able to enjoy it. But he didn't. The price he demanded for that, tacitly, from his socially normative position of power, was to her, too high. She evaded his gaze at every advance, but in such a way that he couldn't help but keep gazing. I know all those moves. Carol did too. This took me back, in the most salutary way, to my reading of H.D.'s little story about Lo Fu's possession of the apple branch. That is, perception as a mode of possession. At Lo Fu's first encounter with the branch, I recalled, he thought that it was out of place, should have been pruned out right from the outset, an outlier. That, I am thinking now, is exactly the first step toward loving something, anything. Its out-of-placeness provokes our notice. It steps forth, unavoidably present. We have, a number of choices in cases like this. Turn to look at a more normal branch, one in its proper place, more suitably beautiful because of all that. Take out a saw and get rid of the rogue lower branch right then, a drastic attempt to right a wrong from long ago. Walk away in confusion or disgust. That, I thought, is what socially normative people are tempted to do when they see someone like me, the way I was last winter at least, avert their gaze towards something better. Try to pretend what had happened had not. Walk away. Lo Fu, to his great credit, does none of these things. He acknowledges the out-of-kilter branch for what it is, and he recognizes immediately how strong and productive it is. That is the second step toward love, seeing what's good in what has stood out for us. Then he studies it carefully in order to understand it for what it is, its intrinsic nature and qualities, down to the finest detail. That is the third and final step toward love, the best kind of love. No grasping, no taking, no grappling toward change. The "you're perfect just as you are" kind of love we all crave. Unconditional. Then Lo Fu goes back to his room with his understanding, not memory, of the branch, and revels in it, loves it even more. He is, as we often say about something we love, taken by it. A possession, as I said, that comes outside in, like we might say an angel or a muse takes us over all good, not fully out of ourselves, not fully the other, but in a balanced liminal state between, poised, attention, a creative state of mind. The branch, with all its apples, its leaves, gets to stay where it is as it is, waiting for his return. It may choose to love Lo Fu for staying with it, paying such careful attention to it, coming to know it, not aggressively, intrusively, just letting it be what it was, openingly, outward toward him. It may have paid just as close attention to him as a way to learn to love him. It, too, may have gone to its room to contemplate this man, to love him, the right kind of love, possession of the best sort. I got all this worked out today to my final satisfaction by turning my reading upside down, like my life, like those little trees reaching down from their upness. I had something amazing happen to me this week. A former student of mine, John Kenick, such a brash thinker, an outlier, the one who first got me hooked on object-oriented ontology, someone I run into from time to time, always enjoy talking to, not so much mentoring as cheerleading, something he doesn't seem to get much from some other professors he encounters, sent me, at my request, a number of essays he had written over the last year or so, just to catch me up on his work. So smart, so strong, so original, one after the other. I'd save the longest one for last. Near the end of that essay, a stunning analysis of, well, it evades easy categorization, I encounter this sentence, one of the most surprising sentences I have ever read, one that, if you had asked me a second before I read it, I would say would never, ever be written for more reasons than I can go into now. He says, "For some leverage on John Ashbery, I move fluidly away, as Ashbery does, and as objects do, I'm sure you've noticed, turning to Paul Kameen's The Poet Comes Out at Night, another poem about poetry," he says, "that brings many of its own objects afore from the putative background for consideration, speculating." He then inserts the poem. "He waits in a thicket, like moonlight, seeping down along twig tip, leaf vein, and bark. Suddenly, the razor edge of his voice leans cold and gentle against my throat, prodding. I follow each flick of the blade, all adazzle with moonlight, and do not know what to say. I empty my wallet in his hands. Empty my pockets in his hands. Empty my hands. He leaves behind nothing but moonlight in a thicket. All that he wanted to say." I thought immediately, how in the world did he find that poem? I wrote it over 40 years ago and never got it published. I actually went right then and checked my CV just to be sure. I know I never read it to a live audience either, because I wrote it about 5 years before I gave my first reading, making it too old to qualify for one of those. Most of my poems are unpublished for many good and bad reasons. I'm at an age that I don't care. 3 years ago this month, I decided to make a website to archive some of them, ones I really like, in my own voice, no text, just readings. I made them in little 5 to 10 minute units of related, to me, material. I didn't remember picking this poem to read, but I went to the site and listened, and there it was, near the end of the last track, an assortment of poems about poetry. He He must have found this poem there, I thought, listened to all the tracks to get to it. Even I had forgotten it was there, but there it was. Then I read his commentary. He says, the poet waits in the thicket, separate from the poem's narrator. His, the poet's, voice leans against my, the narrator's, throat. The thicket, more often an object in the background than a major subject of the poem, is brought forward when its parts, twig tip, leaf vein, and bark, are enlivened and described in detail by the moonlight, which is also usually rendered only as a condition of the scene, although here it figures prominently not only as an image, but as an agent in the narrative. Two versions of the blade are established, one with moonlight and one without. First leaning languidly, cold and gentle, in the dark, and then flicking with a more frenetic sense when it is all adazzle with moonlight. Accordingly, the versions of language associated with the blade changes from first the gentle and prodding for language like adazzle to frantically not knowing what to say, which is a problem if you are narrating a poem. Not knowing what to say, the narrator just describes his actions in more ordinary language, thrice repeating, I empty. As an allegory of writing poetry, I think it is fairly obvious that the emptying refers to all that it requires from all of the objects associated with the entity called Paul to interact with the object poet in order to bring about the object entity poem. 4. The entity that we call poem, words on a page usually, is never the poem. Parts such as words, language, margins, author, reader, and so forth do not summarize the poem. And yet, no holism will do. The poem is not more than the sum of its parts. It is not even just its parts. The poet leaves behind moonlight in a thicket, but not the contents of the narrator's wallet or pockets. The poet does not remain there in the language, nor does Paul. Rather, a particular aesthetic of the poet remains as a particular aesthetic of the poem. But these are versions of the real object withdrawn. What I think I learn about Paul from this poem is an aesthetic of my aesthetic of the poem. I cannot be anything but part of the poem, and I'd be remiss to forget it. Studies of embodiment until now have tried to find unlimited metaphysical meaning as an aesthetic of limited physical meaning by an analysis of symbol. To find the metaphysical as an aesthetic of the physical, but forgetting in a lucid phenomenological trip that symbolism is not real, having no real objects behind it, and that symbolism is instead a way of explaining in our own human limited terms, the aesthetics of the objects, themselves limited, behind the physical entities in question. Weird essentialism is beyond interconnectedness between closed objects. It is about openness alone, for everything, like a symbolic process or connection, is figuratively taken care of by the object's openness, their being in each other and being nothing else. Symbolism is not real, but a makeshift phenomenological explanation. And hence, rituals do not really, emphasis on real, achieve their effects symbolically. Wow, so beautiful. Exactly what that poem was trying to be and do, even though I had never put any of it into any words at all myself, could not in fact possibly have found these words back then because they didn't exist in the intellectual air we breathe. And of course, there being no need to, since I was the only reader. I had tears in my eyes when I was done. Not for me, but for the poem. I have such an attachment to, such a love for the poems I make, which I make out of love, write and revise lovingly, like Lo Fu's branch, each and every one of them, so beautiful, so out of place, so perfect to me. I have a special affection for the ones that have never found a reader other than me, as if they need and deserve my care. I like to think of them from time to time, recite them silently to myself, like when I'm walking. When a poem of mine finds a right reader, even one, I am thrilled for it, like it has grown up and can fend for itself now. John gave this poem everything I had been hoping for it, and more, for the last 40 years, and everything it could possibly have hoped for itself. He was, until I copied that material above, most likely going to be the only person other than me to have ever read that poem. And that would have been enough. Everything. That's what paying attention to anything does. It realizes it. Brings it into being. Not for a purpose, but for what it is. What it has always promised, but needed another to fulfill it. If you are an outlier, you will understand exactly what I mean and why it brought me to tears. That poem feels now, I'm sure, exactly what any loved thing, that manhole cover, for example, feels. It has been looked at with loving eyes. In his reply to the long email I wrote back to him, he posed a lot of questions. Not to me, just questions. I picked out a few of them to answer in my terms. But what about writing, he asked, for unintended audiences when you know your actual one? And it isn't it. That's a great question. The inevitable position of the outlier. The right reader is highly unlikely to be the one who picks up the work right off the bat, maybe ever. I responded with a version of what I always say about my relationship to audience. I write for my intended audience no matter what. My first and foremost audience is me. I was also telling my class that day that once I finish writing something, 99% of its value for me, selfishly, in my bookkeeping system, has already been achieved. I got to think it, say it, and learn it for myself. I have to publish to keep my job, so I work hard to do that. I fully expect and believe that almost no one who reads what I write actually gets it, loves it, thinks it, like I or it would hope. I'm fine with that. I always fantasize about a few ideal readers that maybe someday will find what I write and be taken by it, be inspired by it in some good way. That's a lot to ask for and to accomplish. But I've had it happen many times. A few responses here and there that make me feel, yes, great, that was worth it. Like yours, that's basically how I felt reading your comments on that poem. Okay, this one finally landed. Great. One right reader is enough. The reversal of my reading of Possession in H.D.'s depiction of Lo Fu calls to mind for me the pivotal transitional insight in my long-term relationship with Walt Whitman. There was, for me, for years, a big snag I hit right at the second line of Song of Myself. He says, "What I assume, you shall assume." Sounds like a command to me. Think what I think. I don't like commands. They're like advice, but harsher. They set my teeth on edge, so off-putting. This one, for example, making it hard for me to loosen up and love the wonderful long poem that ensued from it. I just couldn't get over that hump until late in my graduate studies. Then, all at once, I saw it. He didn't mean assume, as in his assumptions, what he believed and thought, how you'd better just take it all in at his word. Stop thinking for yourself. No, not that at all. He meant assume, as in taking in. What I have taken in from the world, all of these wonderful, loving perceptions, stories, relationships, I lay them out for you, who can enlarge yourself by assuming them as well. My gift to you, the purpose of which is not to fill you to the full, but to whet your appetite to go out and assume your own life as lushly, as lavishly, day after day, down to the finest detail, with loving eyes. What goes into me goes out to you. He says basically that all through the poem. What could be more generous than that? today, every day, if I am open enough, a small part of the world will take possession of me. If I can contemplate it lovingly enough, I will assume it into myself, like these three great poets. If I can carry some portion of all that into my words, you can assume it too, if you want. No pressure, just there for the taking. What could possibly be easier or better than that? The ultimate antidote to gray.